The third case for oral argument this morning is Dakota Truck Underwriters and Travelers Insurance Company versus the South Dakota Subsequent Injury Fund. For the appellants is Mr. Mark Marshall, attorney from Sioux Falls, and then representing the Amici State Farm Insurance is Mr. J.G. Schultz, an attorney from Sioux Falls. My understanding, Mr. Marshall, you have yielded 10 minutes on your opening argument to the Amici, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you would be going first?
Yes.
And then on rebuttal, you have yielded 3 minutes and you'd be going second?
That's correct.
All right. And for the appellee, South Dakota Subsequent Injury Fund, Sarah B. Harns, a Special Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. The court should note that Justice Sabers and Justice Zinner have disqualified themselves in this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lee Anderson, a Circuit Judge from Mitchell, to sit in place of Justice Sabers, and the Honorable Brad Zell, Circuit Judge from Sioux Falls, to sit in place of Justice Zinner. Mr. Marshall, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning. As Chief Justice Gilbertson indicated, my name is Mark Marshall. I appear today on behalf of Dakota Truck Underwriters and Travelers Insurance. I am not, by nature, a workers' comp lawyer. It's a specialized area. If the court has questions touching the work comp aspect of that, I believe that your best bet would be to direct those questions to Mr. Schultz. I'm happy to field them, but
now we know why you gave him 10 minutes.
But I think that you may be more satisfied with his responses than mine. This is yet another subsequent injury fund appeal. It is unique because it involves what I call the gap claims. Gap claims, in my terminology, are those that arose from injuries that occurred before July 1, 1999, but where the claim was settled or the case decided after October 1, 1999. That is significant because as of July 1, 1999, the fund was abolished but was subsequently reinstated. And these are claims that vested before the repeal but accrued after the appeal and have been denied as untimely. The appeal presents really one issue, and that issue is whether the doctrines of substantial compliance, equitable tolling, or equitable estoppel render these claims timely. To answer that question, you have to answer a preliminary question. The preliminary question, I think, is whether 62-434.1 is a statute of limitations or a notice provision. That is the statute that says you have to file your claim within 90 days of the date of settlement or date of decision. I think that the proper characterization of that statute is really a notice provision. Although there is a fine line between a notice statute and a statute of limitations, I think the record and the legislation points towards notice. Because notice statutes are those which create your right to proceed. You can't proceed with a subsequent injury fund claim until you give notice, the notice contemplated by statute. On the other hand, a statute of limitations operates as a defense. It bars a claim. Another distinction I think that points towards notice rather than limitations is notice provisions routinely arise in agency proceedings. Statute of limitations are more court-based documents. As I say, there's a fine line between notice and statute of limitations, but whether you say it's notice or whether you say it's limitations, I think substantial compliance or equitable tolling render these cases timely. To satisfy the equitable tolling provisions, you have to provide notice. There can't be any prejudice to the defendant, and you must act in good faith. I think that Judge Wilbur's hang-up was based on Peterson v. Holm and the good faith conduct language that arose from that decision by this court. I think Peterson v. Holm is significant for two reasons. First, it recognizes the statute of limitations notice distinction in rejecting the idea that substantial compliance applies to a statute of limitations. But secondly, I think it's significant in that it talks about equitable tolling and limitations periods. Peterson arose in the context of ongoing litigation. There had been a state court, a federal action filed in which one of the defendants asserted a lack of diversity jurisdiction. This court found that when that notice of lack of diversity jurisdiction issued came about, that counsel for the plaintiff should have filed their action in state court at that time.
Now, if I remember correctly, Peterson versus Holm involves two private parties. Here we have a fund in the state of South Dakota. Haven't we generally said that, except in the most egregious types of cases, we do not apply estoppels against governmental entities?
I'm talking about equitable tolling.
Equitable tolling, equitable estoppel. I mean, it's something that, aren't they all kind of in the same group?
I think they're all in the same group, but I think this court has routinely applied substantial compliance with the notice provisions applying to claims against municipalities. And that's why I think the distinction between whether this is a notice provision or a statute of limitations is important. But I also appreciate your comment about equitable tolling. This is a unique circumstance, Your Honor, and as I was mentioning, Peterson involved two private parties represented by counsel battling it out in court. That is not the circumstance present here. These people operating under work comp, a system designed to function as well as possible without the intervention of lawyers. I mean, your claims adjusters had a statute. They looked at the statute. The statute said your remedy has been repealed. You have a window within which to file these claims, and if you don't file these claims within that window, they are barred. Adjusters, lawyers, the public is entitled to presume that that legislation is constitutional. If the state said you have no remedy because you didn't file within the 90-day window between July 1 of 99 and October 1 of 99, you have no claim. We've taken it from you. And then subsequently, 2 years later, reinstate that with the effort to cure the gap created by the way in which the legislation was enacted. I think that is exactly the arcane procedural snare that equitable tolling was designed to fix. Was the notice timely? Yes. Doesn't make any difference. These are ongoing claims that have been in the system a long time. Is there any prejudice? Absolutely no prejudice at all. And the reason I say that is if they were to amend, if Travelers or Dakota Truck was to amend the final settlement that they have in any of these cases for a legitimate reason and get it approved again, they could file that as a subsequent injury claim. Was there good faith conduct? I think clearly there was. The reason I say there's good faith conduct is because it's exactly the same position that the Division of Insurance themselves have taken in the past. I ask the court to take judicial notice of the briefs filed in the subsequent injury fund mutual insurance case. And as those briefs show, at that time, and that was a time while they had answered these cases, the division didn't believe that the subsequent injury fund was part of workers' comp. The division didn't believe that it related back to the date of injury. It's fundamentally unfair to these insurers who were enticed to remain in this market by the creation of this fund to allow them to recoup part of their costs and to allow them and employers to employ injured people to take that claim away from them, simply because the legislature didn't have its act together when it attempted to repeal the subsequent injury fund, and then tried to clear up the problems that it created. You're right, Chief Justice. The court generally disfavors equitable tolling, but I believe, based on the facts before the court today, this is a circumstance that cries out for the application of that doctrine. Mike Driscoll always taught me, if you don't have anything more to say, you should sit down. And I'm going to do that now, unless the court has any other questions.
And we don't punish or chastise for doing that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Schultz, your billing is that you will educate us on workman's comp. You have 10 minutes.
I'll do what I can. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, it's a privilege to speak on behalf of the MECI here. We appreciate the opportunity to do so, and obviously I thank Mr. Marshall for sharing his time with me. A couple of things that I'd like to kind of follow through on with this matter. Obviously, we're not a party. We're here as friends of the court. We would state on the record that we agree with the appellants that the equitable estoppel and substantial compliance arguments apply, and that constitutional rights have been infringed upon by the underlying decision. But as MECI, we focused our attention in the brief on the issue of the equitable tolling argument, and the reason we did that is to kind of put that 99 statute in some sort of context. The context that we're trying to establish here for the court is, first of all, of course, that statute was found unconstitutional by this court in 2002. So we know there's a problem. There's a problem with the way that thing operated, and this court so found. And it's also been the subject of several other cases in addition. So it's not like this is particularly new territory. We are addressing here for the court, roughly the third time, this statute. And it's obviously a law that was flawed. It was created in a fashion that made a problem for people and still does. So to that extent, I think it's important to note that. Now, let me point out the other part of the context that's probably as important as anything else, and that is the background of how the statute worked. Before 1999, before that statute came into effect, there was the 90-day statute for getting your claim into the Division of Insurance to start the process of trying to make recovery from the fund. So there's one time limit there. There's another time limit in the statutes. It's a 30-day statute that says that once the claim is completed, the Division of Insurance has to act. So they have to act within 30 days of that completion. Those are the only two time frames in which one has to act in that statute, before 99. As of 99, everything changes. And here's how. That statute said that by 10/1/99, by October 1, 1999, there's a deadline to file all the claims. Everything's got to be done by then. Now, that's quite a bit of a change, and obviously it created some tension. Also, you had to have your initial claims filed by June 30, 1999, so you had a start date and an end date. They're virtually 90 days apart, so you really had to run hard. And also, the statute says that no claim was vested, so that kind of gave you the sense that, you know, maybe you don't have a claim at all. So this created this procedural quagmire. This is something that we referenced in our brief. This is the same procedural quagmire that existed in 1992 that the legislature tried to fix. And that problem is that how do you find how much you're going to make a claim for against the fund until the Department of Labor tells you? How do you define the size of your claim until the Department of Labor has either ruled and told you how much you owe, or you made a deal that the Department of Labor has approved? The 99 statute doesn't account for that. It simply didn't account for that, and that's why this court found that statute unconstitutional. But that same procedural quagmire is what created the problems for, I think, a lot of insurers in this state who are trying to make decisions about when to file claims and whether to file claims based upon the statutes that existed as presented to them. Now, these folks are not law trained. These folks are doing what our legislature has been trying to get done, and this court has encouraged all along that workers' compensation system is supposed to be a statutory system, supposed to be a relatively quick and easy remedy. You're not supposed to have lawyers involved all the time, and so these people are trying to operate without the advice of the counsel. I can tell you that obviously you don't run into a lot of adjusters who are attorneys. They are out there, but not commonly. And furthermore, what really happens is these folks see the shutdown, the slam the door policy of the 99 statute, and they figure that's the end of it. No more claims. Quiet. Don't have to worry about that anymore. Shut the door. Don't have to worry about it. So there they are, working through the rest of their files. They've got, I'm sure, piles and piles and piles, just like everybody does. And they don't have any reason to believe that there is a substantive injury fund. The statutes shut it down, and if you look at the books don't even have the thing in there anymore. So this is the conundrum. This is what the problem is for these folks. And so we know that when they can't find the statute in the record, then what are they going to do? They're not going to file claims. That's very, very, very unlikely. So what happens is people rely upon the closure of the statute, or closure of the fund in 99, and they don't do anything with it. Well, lo and behold, in 2001, an initial circuit court decision comes out saying that statute's wrong, it doesn't operate correctly, it's unconstitutional. And then later in 2001, the statute, curative statute, as Mr. Marshall referred to it, is enacted and creates, instead of a deadline that associated with when you put the files in, it creates a very simple, bright line deadline. That is, if you have an injury before June 30, 2001, you can make a claim. Much more simple. The point of reference is the injury, and correctly so. But so here are these folks sitting out there saying, well, now, wait a second. As an adjuster, what am I going to do? What am I supposed to do? What about those old claims that are in that gap, as Mr. Marshall defined it? What about those gap claims where I had a claim before, and I thought I don't have one anymore, so I didn't do anything about it because I couldn't get the Department of Labor to either rule on it or get a stipulation or agreement. What do I do now? Did I lose those rights? And what I think we're here on behalf of the appellants and to ask the court to consider is the idea that those rights couldn't be lost.
Mr. Schultz, may I interrupt you? What happened in this whole area when the 99 legislation was passed? What was the intent or expectations as to how these type of claims would be dealt with? I mean, was it just the end of this type of a system, or was there something else that was kind of happening in the industry or under the law?
Your Honor, my understanding is that the fund closed. The only thing left to the fund to do was to continue to make appropriate assessments, to collect the money from the insurance industry, to redistribute it through its mechanism on those claims that were filed before October 1, 99.
And are assessments continuing to be made even up to the present time as more of these claims are allowed now?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. That's my understanding.
Do you have a feel? I mean, can you educate me as to why this legislation was passed in 99? I mean, what was the basis for it? What caused it?
I'll do the best I can without having been here, but having been somewhat aware of how the process worked, I'll tell you what I understand. It appeared that the idea was to try to shut the fund down as soon as possible, rather than letting it linger. To shut it down as quickly as possible.
But what was the thinking as to why there shouldn't be a fund?
Well, I think there were some arguments back in the distant past about whether the ADA sort of supplanted, I should say, this idea of hiring people that were previously injured and making reasonable accommodations for them now. That's something that I've heard over the years from other sources in addition to the sources here in the state. So that's been one argument. I don't know whether it's true or not, but that might be an explanation.
Well, I mean, was it a kind of an employer-pushed initiative so that they, I mean, wouldn't be surcharged in addition to their standard workman's comp premiums?
Well, certainly, the insurance industry was being assessed for these recoveries, and the money was then put into the fund for redistribution. So clearly there's some money changing hands from the insurance industry into the fund. Whether the employers themselves were concerned about that, I don't know.
I mean, was this a trend nationwide? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, actually it was. Actually it was. From what I know, actually my recollection is that the Minnesota did the same thing we did. And they did it the same way. They did it with a date of loss reference point for shutting the fund down over there. That's my understanding, rather than what we did the first time, which was get the claims in, point of reference.
So as I look through the briefs in your argument, I don't think this equitable estoppel is really much to hang your hat on under the facts here, but it sounds like equitable tolling is where you think you might have some right to relief. Is that fair to say?
Our position, we submitted our brief on the issue of equitable tolling on the concept, basically, that we know that the system by which you try to get these claims done before the Department of Labor acts is a flawed system. We knew that back in 92 because the legislature changed the system that worked like that and said, nope, that doesn't work. We're going to have to do it by reference to when the Department of Labor concludes the case. So now what this seems to be repeating the same problem again in 99, and that's what was so obvious, and this is why we pointed out to the court in our brief that this court has said in a previous case that it was a procedural quagmire. That's a quote.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you. I'm done.
Ms. Herons, you have 20 minutes, counsel.
May it please the court, counselors. My name is Sarah Harns, and I represent the South Dakota Subsequent Injury Fund. I would submit to you that this is a case about proper administration. Did the Division of Insurance, as administrators of the Subsequent Injury Fund, properly apply the laws to each of appellant's or insurer's claims? And I would submit that they did. Briefly, I'd like to take you through what the typical process is for a claim. Obviously, every claim starts out with an employee getting injured. That injury has to go through normal workers' compensation channels. Eventually, that injury is going to end up at the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor is going to make an underlying determination upon that claim. Now, once that determination is made on that underlying injury, that claim is now ripe to move into the subsequent injury fund realm. And that realm has certain limitations and rules on how claims should be dealt with, one of which is SDCL 62434.1, which requires insurers to give the fund notice of any potential claims within 90 days after the Department of Labor makes a determination on that underlying claim. It is at this step and this point that is at issue here today. Insurers had 8 claims. In all 8 instances, an underlying decision was made by the Department of Labor. In all 8 instances, insurers failed to give notice to the Subsequent Injury Fund within 90 days, and that is why they were properly denied. Now, as you can tell,
if they had given the notice, the claims would have been allowed then by the Department of Insurance?
Eventually, they would have. At the time, I submit that they probably would have been denied initially. However,
isn't that a useless act, though? I mean, to say that they could have put their claims in, but their claims would have been denied.
No, it's not a useless act. They would have at least done something to try to preserve those claims. Instead, they did nothing. They waited. They didn't give us notice of any potential claims. They didn't give the rest of the insurance work comp carriers in the state notice that they have a potential claim. Instead, they waited and did nothing. At least they would have done some action to try to preserve that claim. This appeal is fraught with, you know, differences on both sides, but we do agree on lots of things. One, we agree on the facts. There's no dispute that they untimely filed with the Subsequent Injury Fund. There's no dispute that they filed outside that 90-day window. We also agree on certain principles in surrounding this case. Both sides agree as to when laws vest. Everybody agrees that laws vest at the time of the injury. And at the time of these injuries, the Subsequent Injury Fund was still around. The 90-day statute of limitations was still around. Employers and insurers still had a right to file a claim against the Subsequent Injury Fund. We also agree as to when a laws accrue. We agree that laws accrue on that date that the Department of Labor makes a decision on that underlying claim. their right becomes present. They have a right to state a claim. They have a right to give notice, but they didn't in this case. What we disagree on is the equitable exceptions that insurers feel that they are entitled to, specifically the doctrines of equitable tolling and equitable estoppel. And as Justice Anderson, you submitted before that the insurers are really not hanging their hat on the doctrine of equitable estoppel, but rather on the doctrine of equitable tolling. I would like to kind of address equitable estoppel first before moving on to equitable tolling. This court has recognized that four elements must be present in order for the doctrine of equitable estoppel to be valid. Number one, and it's insurers' burden to prove all four of these elements. First of all, that they must prove that the division or the subsequent injury fund made false representations or concealed material facts. Two, they have to show that they lacked real knowledge of what the facts were. They have to show that we intended to conceal or falsely represent something. And finally, they have to show that they relied upon it. Well, I would submit to this court that you don't need to look past element number one, false representations, because the subsequent injury fund made no false representations to insurers in this case. We didn't conceal anything to them. Their argument, of course, is we had a different position in Heritage Mutual. We did have a different position in Heritage Mutual. We're allowed to do that. This court set us straight. They told us that laws vest at the time of injury and that they accrue on the date that the Department of Labor signs off on those claims. That's the way we handle things now. But nowhere in this record does it show that our position in Heritage Mutual was in fact represented to insurers in this case, nor has it been shown that they relied upon our representations in Heritage Mutual to their detriment. Now to deal with the doctrine of equitable tolling, this court...
Wouldn't they have relied upon the law and the language of the law itself?
They should have relied on the law and the language itself. And what this court has said is that you look to the law in effect at the time of the injury. You don't look to the law in effect on the books at the time that the injury at the time the claim accrues. This court has said repeatedly in workers' compensation law, you go back to the time of the injury. If everybody would have went back to the time of the injury, everything still existed. The subsequent injury fund was still around. We all had claims that could have been filed. And that's what they didn't do in this case.
It wasn't very clear from the language of the law that they could even do that, isn't that?
No, but it's been clear in workers' compensation law in principles that this court has decided that rights and obligations for the parties vest at the time of injury. In order for the insurers to prevail on the doctrine of equitable tolling, three things must be present. Notice, lack of prejudice to the defendant, and reasonable good faith conduct on the part of the plaintiff. First, I'd like to briefly touch on element number two, which is prejudice to the defendant. Well, who is the defendant in this case? Well, the defendant is the subsequent injury fund. And who is the subsequent injury fund? The subsequent injury fund is every recognized workers' compensation carrier in the state of South Dakota. Will they be prejudiced? Yes, they will be prejudiced. They are the ones that make assessments to the fund. They are the ones that pool their risk together. They are the ones that are ultimately going to have to pay for each of insurers' claims today, should they prevail. Also, I'd like to touch on the third element, reasonable and good faith conduct on the part of the plaintiff. Did insurers act in reasonable good faith? I would submit that they didn't. In order to prevail on this element, they had to do something, but they did nothing. They sat on their hands. Could they have filed 90 days after the Department of Labor signed off on their claim to preserve some sort of claim? Yes, they could have, but they didn't. Could they have filed after then Judge Zinter ruled in Homestake Mining that 34.7 was unconstitutional? Yes, they could have, but they didn't. They did nothing to try to preserve their claims. Could they have filed while the legislature was trying to remedy the constitutional defect in 34.7? Yes, they could have, but they did nothing. This is what Judge Wilbur focused on in her decision in the circuit court, that they didn't do anything to warrant this doctrine of equitable tolling. They lacked the conduct and the standard of reasonable good faith, and that is why this doctrine should fail here in this case today. I guess I've talked really fast and have 10 minutes left.
Can I ask you a question? I'm just trying to get a feel for the background.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I mean, the subsequent injury fund, I mean, it collects assessments and redistributes them to those claimants who successfully show they should have a reimbursement under this subsequent injury fund. Is that right? And that's the basic
Correct.
The thing. Now, when the law on July 1st, 2001, you know, kind of resurrected a claims procedure, then who would make the decision that were that the subsequent injury fund is going to allow claims such as these eight to be filed and proceed with, or that they were going to shut the door and determine that, you know, it was too late to file? I'm curious as to the mechanism. Who makes that decision? Is it the secretary of the department, or is there somebody else there?
Actually, it is the Division of Insurance. Director Gary Stike has promulgated his authority to us as a legal staff to review those claims and I guess the completeness of those claims, the legality of those claims, and you know, upon our recommendation, we tell him what we feel and how we feel and have authority to act on his behalf.
I mean, is there a specific policy at some point then that came down? I mean, so that everyone was treated the same way, I assume, that if the claim evaporated, you know, during this intervening year and a half, 2 years, it couldn't be filed now? I mean, you follow what I'm saying?
I follow what you're saying.
Who makes this decision and why? I'm trying to figure out kind of what's the interest of the subsequent injury fund or the director of it. Why wouldn't they be, you know, why wouldn't they have taken just the opposite position that, you know, justice requires that these people be given a 90-day chance to file their claims now? Because, you know, as Justice Konecamp said, I mean, wouldn't you really have to agree if they'd filed the claim in on January 1st, well, excuse me, on August 1st of 1999, it would have been denied, and nothing more would have happened until July 1st, 2001 anyway, and so everybody would be in the exact same position as the claimants are now.
But see, we had people file 90 days after the Department of Labor, and it did happen in that procedural, you know, quagmire, and they've been paid their claims today. If they submitted complete claims, they've been paid today.
Well, their claims did just sit until July 1st of 2001, and then they were processed? Is
initially,
that what happened?
Initially, they were denied.
Right.
They appealed to the Department of Labor. At the level at the Department of Labor, they were held in abeyance while this court was handing down its decision in Homestake Mining. Once Homestake Mining was a decision was made, we went back, remedied our denial, and allowed those claims to proceed. But those people did something to preserve those claims. They filed within 90 days after the Department of Labor had came down with the decisions. These insurers didn't. They did nothing. They waited and they sat on their hands until July 1st of 2001, when 34.7 was amended.
Would you address, are you done with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you address the argument about whether this court needs to decide the notice versus the statute of limitations issue?
Quite frankly, I think this court has decided that issue in Homestake Mining. I think the characterization that the court gave 62434.1 in Homestake Mining was that it was a statute of limitations, that it is given, it is a substantive right, it is not a procedural right that can be given retroactive effect. It is in fact a substantive right to file a claim with the subsequent injury fund. So I would submit that this court has already decided that issue and would, you know, probably have to overrule themselves to decide differently. Unless there's any other questions by the court, I would submit that the Division of Insurance, as the administrators of this fund, correctly decided each of appellant's claims that they were untimely filed. There are no equitable exceptions that exist here to revive those claims, and that is why the Circuit Court was proper in deeming them dismissed and untimely filed, and this court should affirm that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ahrens. Mr. Schultz, you have 3 minutes, sir.
I would like to respond to one thing that Ms. Ahrens mentioned here, and that is that some insurers apparently got through the system in that interim time. Just because some people did that doesn't mean the other people lost their rights. I don't understand how that is somehow dispositive of anything, because some insurers had the opportunity or decided to go ahead and do that kind of thing does not mean that these parties are unable to, should not be allowed the opportunity to go ahead and test that remedy and go ahead and get that remedy.
It does suggest, however, that if you were vigilant on your rights and exercised them, there was a way to get paid.
On this condition, Your Honor, if I may be so bold, on the assumption that this court can hold that statute unconstitutional. That's the only way you get there. The only way you get there is to try to anticipate what this Supreme Court's going to do. And I submit that not every insurer is going to be able to figure that out. Some of them did, some apparently, and not everyone's going to be able to figure that out. And not everybody's going to be, and certainly not every adjuster living in Kansas City or Chicago or Des Moines or what have you is going to have a feel for that. This is a situation where I don't believe that fact alone just throws out the claim of this appellant at all. The fact that somebody else made the claim and got it through does not undermine this. So I wanted to make that point in response. I did have one other thing to mention here. The suggestion has been made that this party did not follow the rules, that they failed to follow the rules here, and that's why they shouldn't get a remedy. Nothing could be farther from the truth. They followed the rules. The rules said there was no fund. What are they supposed to do when there is no fund? Are they supposed to start filing away? You see, this is the problem with the position that the fund is and the division is offering here to the court. They're saying, well, gee, you should have followed these rules. Well, the rules had that statute had been obliterated, and it's not even showing up in the books anymore for these folks. Now, how in the world are we supposed to follow those rules? How in the world is this party supposed to follow the rules? They followed the rules. They were confronted with an unconstitutional statute. They could not anticipate that this was going to be an unconstitutional statute. How are they supposed to figure that out? How did they? In other words, what I'm saying is, how do they lose their rights? How did they lose their rights to make a claim in the face of an unconstitutional statute? I don't think they can. I think this court has an obligation to these folks to make sure they have that remedy and they don't get left out in the cold on this kind of thing. This is one of those things where these folks have paid into the fund and fundamental fairness demands that they have a chance to get out of the fund. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Marshall, you have 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. To follow up on that line of questioning, how would we anticipate that it would be held unconstitutional? I don't think that you can impose that burden on anyone, because the presumption that this court follows in reviewing constitutionality is that the legislation is in fact constitutional. If it's reasonable for the court to operate on that premise, it's certainly reasonable for claims adjusters who are not law trained to assume that the statute says and means what the statute says and means. And that is that only those claims filed with the division by June 30, 99, pursuant to law and completed by October 1, 99, are going to be paid. If you're an adjuster and you read that and it's November 99, I think it's reasonable to assume that my claim is gone. The legislature can create the subsequent injury fund. It can take it away.
Well, may I pose this? Everyone would have the option at that point to file a claim and challenge the law or waive their rights. As they went down that road, it appears to me they went down that road waiving their claim. They said, well, we don't have one, we're not going to do anything, we close our file, and then someone else took made a little bit of noise, and the legislature got back in front of the legislature to straighten out something.
And what did the legislature do when they fixed it? The title of the legislation said, it's legislation to extend the time within which to file these very claims. Look at the legislation. That's what they tried to do. They tried to fix the problem that they had created. Now, I heard Ms. Harnes say that we sat on our hands, that we slept on our rights, and things would have been different if we would have acted when Judge Zinner ruled, or we could have acted when the legislature was considering this legislation. What difference does it make if we wait 30 more days until the curative legislation is in place to act? I submit to you that it makes absolutely no difference whatsoever. We acted when it became clear that the legislature intended to extend the time within which to file these funds because it had taken them away from us unconstitutionally. I think that you can only characterize that conduct as in utmost good faith, because before then they were relying on the presumption that the legislative acts are constitutional. Frankly, I am bothered by the idea that the fund can stand before the court and repeatedly say that it is a matter of well-established law that the SIF is part of workers' comp and that injuries vest for purposes of the subsequent injury fund as a date of injury. That is diametrically opposed to the briefs that you've taken judicial notice of, diametrically opposed to the position that the fund took at the time these answers were filed. The legislature has clearly shown that they want the fund to consider and process these claims by its curative legislation. These insurers have been whipsawed, first by relying on legislation that they presumed was constitutional, just as the court does, and now to go through the entire process in the face of curative legislation designed to reinstate the very right that the legislature took away. I submit that this is the ideal time and the ideal case for the application of either substantial compliance or equitable tolling. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. The court will be in recess.